Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
TRE in the afternoon, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good afternoon. You are now listening to Men Talk. It's just gone 5 past 5. With me in the studio today is Russell Hood, Bill Blenkarn and Ben Kavanagh. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you all for coming in. If you're listening at home and you'd like to get involved, you absolutely can. Here's how.
To contact TRE, please call 952-78-4000. Email studio@tre.radio. Send us a WhatsApp on +34 645 99 67 95.
Now, I always like it when I find an article about food, because I think it's a great way to start to talk about food, because we all like food. Yep. So we all have an opinion on food. Takeaways, particularly. Apparently, takeaways are replacing pub and restaurant meals following a cultural shift during the pandemic. Adults consumed up to 74% more calories from takeaways as lockdown saw families turn to the likes of Deliveroo. This is in the UK, obviously. While this has fallen slightly since hospitality venues reopened, calorie intake remains 48% above pre-pandemic levels. So come on, let's be honest. If you, you know, did more takeaways, had more takeaways in the pandemic because of obviously restaurants not being open and things like that, have your habits changed since? How kind of consistent are you with takeaways? Is it a weekly thing? Is it a monthly thing? Or just whenever you feel like it?
I never used to get takeaways.
No?
Until after COVID pandemic.
Really?
Hardly ever used to get takeaways home.
Wow.
Like, used to go out, maybe get something, maybe go and pick something up or have a drink and then bring something home. But yeah, in terms of ordering at home, I never did it until like the last couple of years.
Okay.
And now I do it quite a lot.
Oh, do you? So yeah, you got into a habit and
yeah,
you still...
So it's like once or twice a month, I think, probably.
Okay. Interesting.
Mine, we used to get, before I got divorced, we used to get normally on a Friday night, it would be a Indian or a Chinese night. And then since I've been divorced... Well, I mean, if your listeners could see me now, they'd probably understand that I do enjoy takeaways a lot. And I think also living here, sitting outside and, you know, it's nice to enjoy some comfort food.
Yeah, definitely. We got into a habit during, I guess it must have been during lockdown, around that kind of time, of having an Indian takeaway every Sunday. That was our thing we did on a Sunday. And then we kind of got to the stage where we were like, oh, I feel like we're putting on a little bit of weight here. So we stopped doing that. So we now, it's not a regular thing at all. It's just whenever, and it probably on average once a month, maybe less than that even.
I think I found that during lockdown, I got takeaways less because we were so busy staying at home that going out shopping was one of the few little pleasures you had.
That's true, actually. It was, wasn't it?
You know, and if it was possible, because of where I live, I was allowed to cross into Cadiz. So that was a really exciting experience, you know, yes, going through the police checkpoints, going to the supermarket and then coming home and cooking it all. So I only got back into takeaways after. Yeah, but even now it's just like once in a blue moon.
It's true, isn't it? We forget that, how exciting it was to go to a supermarket. And even more exciting if you saw someone you knew. It was like, hi, how are you doing? What are you doing?
I could plan to meet there. Yes, that was the thing. With masks on, of course.
Like you were doing something wrong. Yeah, let's meet in aisle three. Yeah, it was. I remember because I was still coming to work because I had I was an essential worker coming to the radio, but my husband didn't. And I remember the first time he took the bins out, he actually took a little video because it was like really exciting. I mean, it's just so weird looking back, isn't it? These things that were
normal.
Yeah, took the bins out and he posted his video on Facebook and people were commenting. It was so pathetic. It's ridiculous. But it was exciting. Okay. So from takeaways to afternoon tea. It may be perceived as a bygone quirk of old-fashioned British quaintness, but it appears afternoon tea is seeing a resurgence thanks to younger fans. The article talks about that it's probably quite an Instagrammable experience, you know, going with the pretty teapots and all of that. But it's, yeah, it's a big thing. I wondered how you felt about afternoon tea, if you've had one.
Love it. Times?
Yeah.
Absolutely love it. Okay. Yeah. But I go to a place where they don't bother doing tea. It's either unlimited Prosecco or beer. Well, for me, because I've had the Prosecco too much. But it's great, you know. It's very social. You're outside. I only do the savoury stuff, as I've said to you before. I don't like sweet stuff. So everybody else gets my cakes and I get their sandwiches and pastries.
Brilliant.
And as much Prosecco or beer as I can put away.
Fabulous.
Love it.
So you wouldn't necessarily just do it for a special occasion. It would just be, you know.
Well, if a place is hosting it, a crowd of us will usually get together and go to one.
Okay. You
know? So, yeah. It's great fun.
I think it's also, when you think about the venues, the hotels in London, like the Savoy and places like that, it's actually a destination afternoon, and it is very Instagrammable, right?
Where they've got cream tea,
they've got the scones, they've got, you know, look at me, here I am at the Savoy. And
it's very expensive, though. When you work it out, you think, okay, I'm drinking tea and eating cucumber sandwiches and spending about £90 for the privilege. I mean, it can be really, in London, I'm talking about, in these nice hotels, they're crazy expensive. And when you think about what you're getting, you need to really love it to want to do it.
I think that kind of appeals to the people you're talking about as well, because if you can show that you're doing it, it's kind of like an opulence to it, isn't there?
Yeah.
And Instagram loves all that stuff.
Oh, you know?
Yeah, and it's also doing something different to the norm. You know, all the ladies lunching, or I can't see a load of guys going out for cream tea afternoons, if I'm honest, but I might have got that wrong. But it's just something different from the norm. And I don't think, you know, in a lot of instances, the price really comes into it. It's just something different to do.
It's a day out.
Yeah. I've done it a couple of times, and I'm not a massive, massive fan, because I'm not into lots of bread. I wouldn't necessarily, if I was going out for, I don't like burgers particularly, because I don't want the bread. I'm not like,
you're one of them, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm one of
them. You go to McDonald's and say, can I have a cheeseburger with no cheese?
No, I'm not one of them. Not quite that bad. But no, I don't like eating lots of bread. So the idea of having, you know, loads of sandwiches and then a scone and then some cakes, I just feel like it just too much.
I'll give you the name of a place afterwards where you can actually have lots of really good savoury stuff that's not lots of bread.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, how do they do an afternoon tea without bread?
Well, they do some sandwiches, but they do lots of pastries and things, and it's excellent, you know, like little things. You know.
I could do pastry.
I mean, I just leave the scones and stuff.
Yeah.
But it is funny because, you're absolutely right about it being a destination thing in the UK. I remember once going to one at the Waldorf in London, and that was hysterical, but mainly because we just drank cocktails all afternoon. It is social, but it's only if you do it with a crowd of people. And you're right, you wouldn't do it with a bunch of your mates. But if you got a good mix of people, fantastic.
Yeah.
Very sociable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Something different.
Yeah.
Okay, we better take a break.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Men Talk with me in the studio today, Russell Hood, Bill Blenkan and Ben Kavanagh. We are talking about trigger warnings now. There's a couple of articles here, so I'm trigger warning before we start talking about it. Oh. So trigger warnings is only something that I've kind of heard of in the last few years, but it seems to be talked about a lot. So this is the idea. It happens sometimes on podcasts that I'm listening to, and they'll say, oh, trigger warning, and they'll start talking about a sensitive subject. It could be a child abuse, it could be abortion, it could be anything that people listening might, you know, suddenly get really upset about. So they'll say, trigger warning, this next piece is talking about abortion or something like that. So, you know, people aren't going to be driving along hearing something and then suddenly get really distraught and have to pull over, all this kind of stuff. So they're talking about trigger warnings on books. They're talking about trigger warnings at the theatre. There's an author, Joanne Harris, who is the author of the book Chocolat, which was made into a film. She says that She is on board with trigger warnings and believes that they should be added to all books to make readers feel safe. So this would be like putting on whether it's the front cover or the inside cover of a book. And I guess saying the kind of things that we're used to seeing at the front, at the beginning of TV programs. So this book may contain adult themes of sex, violence, child abuse, whatever, that kind of thing, saying it in books. And they're also talking about doing it at the theatre more. I just wondered what your thoughts were on trigger warnings.
Crazy. That's my thoughts. Honestly, where do you stop with this?
Yeah.
Right? If you, you know, you look at movies that go out, they go out and it says PG, 12,
yeah,
18, right? It's a warning that there's content in there that could be offensive that you could take offense to.
Mm-hmm.
It also pre-warned you. Well, what do? You're reading a book and then it says all of a sudden, trigger warning, the next paragraph might upset you. Come on. You know? Come on, people.
I think it's undercover.
But what I'm saying is when will they go to the, you know, we've got to protect people's, you know, their mental health and things like that. And so we've got to make sure we give them enough warning that something like that. I'm not a good one to talk about this because I really feel it's, they've got to stop.
I'm with Bill on this one because, I actually read something quite recently that was discussing the term triggered to be triggered. And years ago, it was reserved for like extreme psychological cases where people have PTSD, trauma,
mm-hmm.
Shell-shocked people who've had real difficult things happen to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was reserved for a very serious psychological analysis.
Yeah.
Rather than just something that might upset you or something that might cause you to think things you didn't want to think.
Yeah.
And it's like you said, it's like, where do you reduce it down to such a thing that it gets thrown around willy-nilly, I guess is the word. And
something that I think it can be kind of useful for is when we're talking about young adult books. And I came across this recently because I was looking for a book to buy for my goddaughter, who is 13, and she's quite a grown up 13 and she loves reading. And I was looking at various young adult books that are in the bestseller charts. And there was one that's been doing really, really well. And I was reading reviews and people saying it was amazing. So I bought it. And then having bought it, I then suddenly came across all these other reviews that were talking about the explicit sex that was happening in the book. Mm-hmm. And I panicked and thought, oh God, this sounds way too adult for this 13-year-old, and quickly got in touch with her mum and said, oh, I hope this is okay. I'm really sorry. I didn't realise. And anyway, it was all fine. But young adult is such a loose term when it comes to books. I wonder how many parents kind of, you know, research before buying books for their kids to make sure that they're okay about the content that's in it. So I kind of think, I don't know if that's the same as trigger warnings, but I think it would be good to understand a little bit more of the content of books when you're buying it for anyone under 18.
Well, I think one of the key things is that there are so many reviews on everything these days. There is no excuse for going into a film, a book, a TV series, or anything without some idea of the content.
Exactly. We can find it all on the internet.
Exactly. So if you're going to go into the theatre and need to be told what the premise of the play is about, are you really that daft? You've just spent X amount of money on a ticket for a show you know nothing about?
Mm.
I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
But then you get, I think there are some that are legitimate, like the ones at the beginning of programs and films. The one about contains flashing images, you know, it could provoke an epileptic fit.
Yeah.
But the most ridiculous one I saw within the last couple of weeks was contains depictions of nicotine use. I mean, come on. That's just, oh no, somebody's going to light a cigarette. All these reform smokers are suddenly going to go mad.
That's so ridiculous.
Bonkers.
You're going to be shocked at real life.
Oh, I also think you've got to look at when you talk about the books and talk about, I mean, I've got a 17-year-old daughter in it, and anyway.
There's obviously a story there.
No. Just the father, you know, being a father. But I'm 47, when I was first taught about sex education at school when I was 15, right? That's when they, the birds and the bees, they showed you the video of all of that. What age do they teach them now? It's very, very young.
Really?
Very young, yeah. So you've also then got to look at, you know, the movies, the books and things like that. They understand what, you know, what sex is.
Yeah.
You know, so they understand. And also, let's face it, you know, again, I'm 47. These guys are obviously younger than me, as are you, Hannah. But if you think back to TV when we were younger, their sort of age, you never really saw much in terms of sex on TV or even in the soaps, EastEnders, Coronation Street. It's all very, they get to a very risque point in some of these things. So I think, as you say, the trigger in, you know, I would say that good trigger points would be on movies is if it's an actual documentary about a live incident. So, for example, The Twin Towers.
Yeah.
You know, that warning, you know, we're going to warn you, this happened in real life and to real people, so it can, you know, that I understand. For the rest of it, come on, stop being, you know, we're not
also putting cotton wool also out. There's a difference when you're talking about under 18s and young people. That's a whole different thing altogether.
It is, isn't it?
And of course filmed media is very different because, you know, it needs to have a warning because once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. If you're reading a book and it's getting a little bit, you're not too sure, you can always put it down.
Mm.
You know, you're not going to necessarily carry on reading if you think it's going somewhere you're not going to like.
Yeah.
I mean, I also have done, you know, Children with Cancer UK's charity event in London. And obviously, I'm sure you've all been to a ball like this, but, you know, at the end, you play a video. Which is really hard hitting, which gets people to put their hands in their pockets.
Yeah.
Mm.
Now, this would mean, in a way, they're saying to me, I should now put something up to say the next video you're about to see can cause. Of course, they know. They're there to support.
Yeah.
You know, they know what it's about. They know what's coming.
Yeah.
You know. So again, I just think society's got to stop allowing people to kind of, every time something like this comes up, you know, that they don't jump on it and try and make something of it.
Well, there needs to be a degree of common sense. You're absolutely right about that. And it does take a kind of arbiter, but who is the arbiter of what goes out? But if you look back, and I'm a good deal older than you. Thank you. You look at what's on TV in standard advertising any time now. Yeah. Now, I compare that with what was in TV when I was a teenager. You know, the amount of stuff that gets advertised now, which we just take for granted, it's perfectly normal, you know, feminine hygiene products, that was never advertised. You know, contraceptives, that was never advertised. Everything down these lines, it's all fair game now. And it's quite normal. Why shouldn't it be? But that's changed. So, of course, awareness, mixing the two points about the young people and what they're exposed to, that all happens from a much earlier age. And I'm sure I don't have kids. I've got cats, but luckily they don't ask me any questions. But I'm sure kids are asking questions at a much younger age as well.
Mm.
So, yeah, but back to the trigger warnings, apply a degree of common sense.
Yeah.
But also anything to do with the arts, we should also say that it's meant to expand our horizons and challenge the viewpoint. So perhaps we should be open to things that we may not be entirely comfortable with to see if it changes our viewpoint.
That's a great point, actually.
Yeah, for sure. They were talking about in this theatre article that there were trigger warnings for audiences watching a play of Julius Caesar, saying that there will be the use of stage blood.
Dun, dun, dun.
Are people going to be upset seeing stage blood? Or do they need to know, don't worry, we haven't actually stabbed this guy. This is stage blood. It's not his real blood. He's not actually dead.
No actor was hurt in this scene.
Yeah, exactly.
He dies every night.
Yeah, exactly. That's just madness. Okay. So this is talking about 9 to 5. Dolly Parton sang that working 9 to 5 was all taking and no giving, but traditional hours might actually be good for you. There was a study that was done. The striking results were seen that those who had stable work hours, as in 9 to 5, in their 20s and then transitioned to more volatile hours in their 30s, basically made people, their work schedules giving them poor sleep, fatigue, emotional exhaustion, leading to health issues.
So, do you know, my answer to that straight away, one of these, mobile phone.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think back to the traditional 9 to 5, and has there been a 9 to 5? When was a? I don't know when I've ever worked 9 to 5.
I
actually.
Haven't much, really, to be honest.
But you know, for me, the problem is, well, certainly in my industry, I'm accessible all the time because, you know, people want to call me when they've finished work or whatever, or they're in a different part of the world. But we never had mobile phones or emails, really.
Yeah.
So back then, 9 to 5 really kind of meant 9 to 5. There was no other way of communicating with somebody unless you rang them on the old, you know, dial-up phone.
Yeah.
Whereas now, society is such that I don't think you ever stop working, do you? I mean,
it's
you ever
very
switch
difficult.
Off?
It is very difficult. And this is something I do know quite a bit about, funnily enough, because I run a small recruitment consultancy. Now, most of the roles that we get in will be 9 to 5, 5:30, or 6. So these more and more companies have introduced a degree of flexibility, but these are fairly classic office roles. But there'll be core hours, say maybe 10 to 4, that have to be covered, but people can start whenever they want, before that, and finish whenever they want after that, so long as they do a certain number of hours a week. But the big thing we saw with the pandemic again was people lost that routine and they were starting to work from home more. But what was actually happening was people were starting earlier because they weren't commuting. So they were actually starting at 8 o'clock instead of 9.
Mm.
And they were frequently running on to 7, 8 in the evening because, well, there was nothing else to do.
Yeah, why
and
not?
And so people were working longer hours. Companies were getting a lot more bang for the buck. This is the downside that people don't see when they talk about getting people back into the office. So companies were benefiting big time from this. Mm. Because that structure had gone. And a lot of people rely on that structure because it's, oh, yes, get out of the office at a certain time. Like you, I'm accessible anytime. Small business owner, you have to be. But for an awful lot of people, having that structure allows them to move their days around it. Mm. The big question we now have are all these studies about the four-day week. Now, I've heard pros and cons. Some places love it. Some places absolutely hate it, but I think it depends on the industry.
Mm.
I mean, industries like these, obviously it's not going to happen, but there are ones where it could be very successful. So I'm kind of on the side that it's on its way out, but it will always have a place, you know, the standard 9 to 5 structure in some form or other.
Yeah. Have you ever worked 9 to 5, Ben?
Not really, no.
That's why Ben's got hair and it's... You know,
I was just thinking as to what the actual article said there, because I think what it says is people who transition from doing 9 to 5 to doing more regular jobs, they experience all these symptoms,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's funny because I've always worked nights in the main, and I found it messed me up when I went to 9 to 5.
Yeah.
If I was getting up in the mornings and working all day, it was ruining me.
Yeah.
Whereas
it's
if I'm active all night and just relaxing all day, that's my normal kind of rhythm, you know? So it's interesting. It's almost like we are adaptable enough to do this stuff, but it has to be, there has to be a consistency to it, and you have to have your own routine, whatever that may be.
Yeah. Yeah.
Consistency, absolutely. Routine, I think that's the healthiest thing.
Yeah.
And I also think that, as you were saying, you know, that when we went into the pandemic, you know, before pandemic, somebody says, I want to work from home tomorrow. Really? Why do you want to?
Absolutely.
Why, yeah. No, you're not working from home tomorrow.
Yeah.
Now, all of a sudden, everybody's working from home. And as you say, you know, they're going, wow, we've got more sales coming in. You know, that's been done. This, you know what? Let's not. And in actual fact, the companies, it flipped back on them and them saying, why do we need this huge office space?
Exactly.
We don't need this anymore.
Yeah.
Let's get rid of it. So I think there's a balance that needs to be found, because I do think it can affect your mental health if you're not going into an office for certain periods of amount of time. And,
definitely.
You know, but I think there will be a bigger growth in office spaces where it's like a shared environment for people to go to. So,
but if people are used to going into an office and, you know, doing their job and interacting with the other staff, then being at home on your own and not having, you might be able to get more work done, but not having that interaction.
Well, it's that social interaction that's one of the key things, because it's one of the hidden benefits of having people working together.
Yeah.
Because out of that interaction, new ideas very often will come and people will find new ways of doing things, or somebody will suggest something, somebody will trigger something, you know, and suddenly, oh, it's like we've got something else we can look at. Whereas people working in a vacuum on their own, you know, don't have that interaction, are not able to bounce off. So finding that balance, it's exactly what you said, you know, finding the structure that works well, because some people love working on their own, but they begin to become more hermit-like.
Absolutely.
And when I first came out of lockdown, I found it very strange going anywhere where there were crowds of people. And in fact, it made me a bit nervous because I just wasn't used to it for 2 years.
Yeah.
It's odd. I still can't go to La Cañada.
No, are you serious?
I just don't like
that's
it.
Something actually. Else. Yeah. Brilliant. We better take another break.
Hannah Murray. TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Men Talk with me in the studio today, Russell Hood, Bill Blenkarn and Ben Kavanagh. There is a piece about anger. I thought this was really interesting. Going for a run, taking a few deep breaths or even screaming into a pillow are tried and tested strategies for coping with anger. But the best thing to do could be to write down your reaction on paper and then throw it away, according to research. So in your experience of life, what are your best ways of expressing anger and getting over anger? What would you generally do? And do you think writing it down would help?
I mean, I would go with a bottle of Rioja. I'm not going to lie. I mean,
fair enough.
Writing it down would just infuriate me more.
You reckon?
Yeah. Well, you've got to find a pen for a start.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. No, I just, for me, I've... go for a walk and try and clear it out of my head. But typically, I just have a drink. I mean, it's just a way of chilling out.
Yeah, fair enough.
Nice right boot through something nearby usually does the trick.
Let's not stand near Ben when he's angry then.
No, I think the idea of going for a walk is a great idea. But I get the idea that writing it down can be quite cathartic and actually... If you start putting it down, and especially if you put down what you think of the person that's angered you, assuming it's a person, and you put everything down, but you would never be able to say it to their face, you know, that can be quite cathartic.
Mm. Yeah.
Maybe burn it. Don't just chuck it away in case somebody finds
yes,
it.
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, it kind of makes sense to me. I don't know if I could be bothered writing it all down, but I certainly think voicing my thoughts and opinion to a trusted person, to family member, husband, best friend, whatever, that kind of helps me. I think to be able to express any kind of emotion, if you're sad, have a cry. If you're happy, have a dance, you know, whatever. If you're feeling any type of way, I personally get huge benefits of just expressing it and then being able to move on afterwards, whether that's sadness, happiness or anger.
Bizarrely, I think you can express it to no one as well. Yeah. I think
if you
just say it just to yourself.
Saying it out loud,
I also, at the moment I don't, I am looking for one, but a dog.
Okay, having
talking to the dog.
You know, that's a great idea.
Because
he's not going to say anything. And, he won't judge you.
No,
you can't say anything back. So, I just, you know, and then go for a walk with the dog.
Perfect.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. Like that. Okay, hair we're talking about now. Half of British men admit basing their hairstyle on celebrities' styles. A poll for a health platform, Hims, found that 48% wanted to look like stars, with David Beckham, Brad Pitt and Ryan Reynolds being some of the most popular ones. So does this make sense? You know, have you over the years gone with like a picture and saying, I want it looking a bit like that?
I confess when I was 17, so it's going to be before a lot of your time, I went into Inverness and got a Kevin Keegan perm.
Oh,
excellent.
Wow. Oh.
Now, I was living in quality. The Highlands.
Brilliant.
I'd love to see a picture of that.
Yeah,
luckily, none
same.
Exist. But I was living in the Highlands, and I was at school with where all the other guys were getting a haircut with a bowl at the kitchen table in the farmhouse.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I was walking about with a perm.
So you stood out,
unfortunately. Unfortunately, my mother was a teacher at the same school. She was very embarrassed because I had a beard and moustache as well, and everybody thought I was a supply teacher. Anyway.
Fabulous.
But since then, no.
No, fair enough.
Absolutely not.
Ben?
No,
nothing. You never thought about that?
No. Maybe passively, maybe without really knowing it. I think probably we do get influenced by these things subconsciously.
Yeah,
but
I think so.
I never specifically gone, I want that haircut. No.
No, okay. No. Bill?
Well, the fact that I have no hair, just like to point that out to your viewers. My hair went a long time ago. Even when I had hair, it wasn't something that I would...
No. It's funny, isn't it? Because it says like over 50% of men, but...
How old are they?
Yeah. Hipsters? Gen Z?
Yeah. Maybe. It doesn't mention age. Okay, this is a fascinating one. Manners. Manners may maketh man, but most youngsters now think traditional table etiquette is outdated. Some 60% of those aged 12 to 27 think table manners are no longer important. More than three quarters said they don't care about elbows at the table, while more than half think it's unimportant which way round a knife and fork are held. It's not just youngsters as well. 54% of Britons of all ages thought that table manners are a thing of the past.
No. I massively disagree.
No, disagree completely.
I 100% disagree. And I tell you why. My daughter hates roast dinners, right? But when I was married, maybe that's partly the reason why I got divorced, but anyway, one of the things I always insisted on a Sunday was that we sat down. No mobile phones, none of that. And you talk.
Yeah.
Right? It's an hour and a half, 2 hours, and it's just you talk. And, you know, I think it's not only those traditions, but, you know, when I came home from school, the first thing I had to do was clean my shoes, you know. So there's lots of traditions I think people look beyond. But for me, the table manners, don't put your... it's rude. These are the things that we've let slip.
Yeah.
I disagree with the elbows bit.
I find myself doing elbows on table sometimes. And I think to myself, oh, I shouldn't do this. And then I think,
Everybody else as well.
Yeah, why? Yeah. I get some manners can be explained.
Yeah.
And eating with your mouth full, for example, doesn't look... That's not eating with your mouth. Talking with your mouth full. Yeah. If you're talking, you've got loads of food in your mouth, it doesn't look very nice. So that kind of makes sense to me as to why it's not a great thing to do in front of people. But having a chat and kind of... You know, casual. I don't mean like necessarily sitting massively with your elbows on the table.
Yeah.
But sometimes with your eyes, is that the same? Arms rested on the table, or is it specifically elbows?
I think if you've eaten and you're sat and whatever, then yeah. I mean, I'll you know,
you kind lean of on the table. You do, lean, don't
but,
you? That's what
but
I mean.
I don't. I can't lean, and it's not possible.
No.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I can quite happily sort of do that and using a fork or whatever. But it depends on the company as well. Because if you're in a formal setting, I would feel very uncomfortable if somebody was being very uncouth and lack of manners.
But this is why it's important that it's taught. I don't believe that every household needs to obey them all the time.
No. That's
but
true.
You need to teach them so that when you're in a different situation, you don't give yourself away as being a Luddite.
Yeah.
How many children or teenagers look at the table setting and go, why have I got three forks? Why have I got two knives? Because they've not been taught.
It's about education, isn't it?
Like you say, it's an education. Yeah. And to have the knife and forks around the right way, I mean, isn't that just
obvious?
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's a thing that we all know. Everybody knows where they go.
Yeah.
But I come face to face with people's etiquette on a daily basis at work. And you can tell when there are families who just haven't been taught by the previous generation how to behave in a certain situation.
Yeah.
And table manners is just one example, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you're a staff member and you're trying to negotiate these people who don't know how they're meant to be acting, you're kind of dealing with sort of bedlam. It's chaos.
Yeah.
Not everyone... I mean, I was always taught, for example, before you call the waiter, make sure everyone knows what they're ordering. But people don't do that.
Right.
People just call you over when they think what they want.
Yeah. And then you're standing there waiting while everyone's...
And it just inconveniences everybody else around you. And this is why it's important to know how to do things.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think your point about the mobile phones at a table, I'm aghast when I walk in somewhere and you see whether it's a family or a group of four people and everybody's like that, looking at the phones, and nobody's interacting with each other.
Yeah.
What's that about? Why bother sitting down and having dinner together?
Yeah. Well, I curse the QR codes, because the menus, because that happens all the time. Whenever my husband and I are out, I say this every time it comes up on this show, but just because it's a new group of people, when you have to look at your phone to get the menu, the two of us will be out for dinner and we'll both be looking at our phones, and I feel the need, can feel like people in the restaurant, they've got nothing to say to each other anymore.
Yeah.
And I feel like going, no, we're fine. We're just looking at the menu. All good here.
Paper menus.
Because it looks like you.
Yeah.
It's annoying. Go back to paper menus. Yeah. We don't need QR menus anymore. Definitely. Right, last ad break.
Hannah Murray. TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the last part of today's Men Talk. With me in the studio today, Russell Hood, Bill Blenkin and Ben Kavanagh. Okay, here we go. Children questioning their gender should not be locked into radical medical treatment, a landmark report is expected to recommend. This came out this week. Last month, NHS England announced a ban on GPs prescribing puberty blockers, which pause physical changes in youngsters such as breast development and facial hair growth. To be honest, could never believe that this was actually okay, but they've stopped that now. And they're basically going back to basics and saying, before giving children any kind of treatment, whether it's surgical or pills, they should talk to them first. Which, is kind of revolutionary, isn't it? Which, again, kind of seems really obvious to me. Mm-hmm. And really dangerous that they were ever doing it the opposite way.
Well, I had no idea that they were doing it way.
It's news to me,
You just kind of make the assumption that of something of this magnitude would actually be discussed.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, I take the view that anybody under 30 is a child anyway. So the idea that anybody under 15 should be... Yes, they should be questioning if they're feeling things are not right, but should they be making fundamental changes to their life at that point without all the information and without perhaps a level of maturity? I don't know, maybe I'm on dangerous ground here.
I mean, I think there's got to be enormous psychological intervention before you start prescribing young people, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, medical things or anything like that. I mean... obviously you don't grow up. I mean, like Russell rightly said, you're still quite young until you're 30. You're still learning. You're still working out what's what about everything in life. And to have things so fundamentally change at such a young age when you're still developing is bizarre.
I think it's crazy. Right. And I get that. I absolutely understand and respect that some children, adults, teenagers, whatever can 100% feel like they've been born into the wrong body.
Yeah.
That they've been born a female, but they don't feel like a female, and they want to transition and become a man. I absolutely get that that's a thing. I'm not saying that it's not. But kids, I guess, can feel like that and then change their minds. And that's obviously the worrying thing. I mean, there was a time when I was growing up, I didn't have many female friends. I used to hang out with the boys playing football. I used to play with Transformers instead of dolls. And, you know, I mean, who knows? If someone said to me, why don't you take this pill and you could be a boy? I might have gone, okay, cool. I'd love to be a boy. When I absolutely didn't really want to be a boy, it was just a phase of my life when I preferred hanging out with boys and doing boy things.
But I think there's a much bigger issue than this.
Yeah.
And I think the confusion here, and no, this shouldn't, you know, like you say, I mean, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever to be prescribing pills before they've gone through a, you know, psychoanalysis or whatever you would call it. But the problem in this day and age is that in schools, at a very young age, they are teaching children that it's right and it's fine if they want to be a boy or a girl or gender neutral or a cucumber or whatever they want to identify themselves as. And that will have a knock-on effect as they grow up, because the confusion. So what you're saying, you know, that maybe they go through that process and then all of a sudden they feel, what have I done? You know, that mentally, medically could be irreversible to a certain extent, but also mentally, you know, damage, you know, children. I you know, I have a couple of friends who their children have gone through it. And, you know, as parents, they've really struggled to deal with it, but they've been as supportive as possible. And I think when you talk to them and they've really spoke, you know, talked through everything, but they're not going through medical processes at the moment.
No.
They're saying dress as you want to dress, have a haircut as you want to have a haircut. If you want to play football, do that. If you want to play rugby, we'll find those avenues. But until such point where you really know 100% as an adult that you want to make that move, you know, just hold off.
I think in many ways, it's almost this like instant gratification culture spreading into very serious things because it's like, I want it now.
Yeah.
I want to be a boy. I want to be a girl now.
Yeah,
it's like
because we're used to that life where you can just get things whenever you want.
Why don't you wait until you're in your like early 20s or something and then make a decision when you've had a long time to think about it and you've experienced different parts of your life and different life at a slightly different age.
Thankfully, you can't just go to Turkey and get it done.
No,
yes. Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
otherwise people would.
But could you imagine how scary that would be if you can, you know, they start advertising that?
Well, it's only a matter of time, surely.
Yeah, but I think the key thing, the key point for me that I think you both made is that any child going through anything, whether it's gender, sexuality, whatever, they should be totally supported. But as you say, not encouraged or enabled to make serious physical changes that will affect the rest of their life until they've done it for it a length of time and they've gone through and it becomes an informed decision. And dare I say it, there is an awful lot of fashion about the subject at the moment. And let's face it, a lot of kids are very easily influenced. So there is this, and you, I mean, people flirt with all sorts of fashions, but they aren't fundamentally life changing, whereas this is. So I think there has to be a lot more talk about it. And I know a lot of, you see a lot of activism around all areas like this. We say, well, you're blocking their development, but actually just saying, make sure it is actually their genuine development.
Just have a bit of patience.
I mean, it must be, listen, it must be really, really tough if, you know, if there are kids that do feel this way, I say if, I know there are, that do feel like they want to transition and they're really miserable and feel just completely unhappy in their own skin and they do want to make that change. It must be really, really hard for the kids and for the parents going through that. It's, you know, it's easy for us to kind of go, you know, be patient, wait 2 years in your early 20s or whatever. I do agree that that's what they should do, but it must be very difficult for everyone involved if they are feeling a certain way for a certain length of time.
But where at what age, and again, I'm too old now to remember this, but what at what sort of age do you stop, does your body stop developing into either, you know, from a child, teenager to an adult? What is it, 16?
I think it's 21, actually.
Was it 21?
Yeah.
So your body is still developing constantly. So again, to start playing around with, you know, because you are playing around with emotions, the brain, everything.
Yeah.
Look, as I say, if it's really bad and they're really in a state, then I understand that you can go to certain levels to start that process. So long as they've got the right support in place and it's being done for the right reasons. But otherwise, you know, wait till your body is, listen, if I want to be a woman, I could go and dress up, right? And go out, shave, you know, whatever, and go out on Friday night as a woman, you know, if I wanted to. If I really felt that then I wanted to become a woman and it meant a lot to me, then I could transition and have and surgery and what have you. So I don't think it's any different really for the younger. The problem that they have is the pressure from other teenagers that maybe, you know, laugh at them, make them feel, you know, that it's bad. And that's where it becomes hard.
Yeah.
You know, that is a very challenging thing to handle. And I think, you know, that if that part of it could be alleviated, I think a lot of younger people would back off from making that instant want, you know, I want this now.
Yeah. Moving on from this, but a similar kind of subject with a, yeah, really shocking headline. We went to see our daughter get a school prize and it was handed to a boy called Tommy. These are parents talking about their 14-year-old daughter who, yeah, unbelievably, that she left home to go to school as this 14-year-old daughter, you know, looking like a girl. But then when they went to see her at school, she, her appearance was completely different, and the parents realised that she was asking to be addressed as Tommy at school and was a boy at school, and the teachers knew that and were okay about that, and the parents had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'd
question the school for starters. Why would they not be checking in with the parents that,
yeah,
you know, is this, you know, you understand that this is going on.
Yeah, exactly. That should be so obvious, shouldn't it?
And also the parents, I'd be questioning.
Yeah. I'm sorry, you live in the same house as this person.
Yeah.
You know, how can you not be aware of what's going on? And other than, is there a massive degree of deception going on? And as you say, the school should have just said, you know, is this with your blessing and support, one would have thought,
yeah,
because schools are in loco parentis. Well, people are at school.
Exactly. If kids are misbehaving, the teachers tell the parents. Yeah. You know,
school parents' evening.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Hi, we're here to see. We're talking about Tommy.
Yeah.
Tommy, now we're here to talk about Jen.
Yeah, you know. Exactly.
Did they ever go to the parents' evenings?
Exactly. You know. It's just bizarre, isn't it? How it's
there's
all
an awful
kind
lot of
of
questions about that story that require answering.
Yes.
But what a shame that the girl didn't feel that she was able to go to her parents about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Place. Yeah. And this just goes back to what we said about having the correct support in the first place.
Yeah, she feels more comfortable at school than she does with her parents, and that's really sad.
Yeah.
We are coming to the end of the show. We have 1:30 left. I'm not sure that's long enough to tackle another subject. So we shall say thank you very much for coming in today. Thank you to Russell. Have a good weekend. Thank you to Bill.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. And thank you to Ben. Have a good weekend. And coming up is the news at the top of the hour at 6 o'clock, international headline news, followed by Howard Brereton with Spain Today. So make sure you don't miss that. I'm saying have a good weekend. I know it's only Thursday, but I don't work Fridays. So my everyone's thinking, weekend? It's only Thursday. She's got the day wrong. No, I haven't. My weekend starts in a few minutes' time. So that's why I said it. So have a good one, and I will be back. My phone... How do I get my watch to stop talking to me? I need to change that. My watch keeps...
For the next show.
Well, maybe you can show me in a second. My watch keeps talking to me. It's really inappropriate. I need to shut her up. So, yes, I will be back on Monday at 4 o'clock with TRE in the afternoon. Can I tell you who I've got on Monday? Well, Mark will be with us, obviously, talking about old sport. He's on at 5:35. I can get this to work. I've got 20 seconds. Yeah. Oh, I've got Neil back in. Neil will be with us from Funeral Care Spain. I say all like it's really exciting talking about funerals, but he knows his stuff, definitely. So we're always really worth listening to him and answering any questions that you have about funerals in Spain, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. So don't miss that. Have a good one.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.